We wouldn't be able to keep this archive going without your support. Donate online today at wyxr.org.
You're tuned into Strange Mysterious Sounds. This is the Big G here every Wednesday from 4 until 5 p.m. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate having you along. We lost a great musician, Memphis musician, about a week ago, Don Nix. Produced many great Memphis records. Produced the Sid Selvage LP that came out under an Enterprise. He was also in the Marquees, and made several records himself for Enterprise, as well as Elektra. And he had a really an amazing career. Great songwriter, probably the best known song to a lot of people who are not familiar with his catalog is actually a song that he wrote that was recorded by Moloch and then later recorded by Freddie King and was used in the Eastbound and Down TV show. It got some pretty good love. Most people, when that was on, were watching that. So, yeah, Don Nix, maybe not a household name, but if you're into Memphis music, you probably know about Don Nix. And I'm going to play a little interview I did with him several years ago. And later on, I'll maybe intersperse the interview with some tunes that Don recorded or produced. So keep it tuned right here, WYXR 91.7 Memphis. We're raised by sound. Here's interview with Don Nix.
I wanted to start off with talking a little bit about one of your first recording.
Ben, you definitely had some high points that people are familiar with, and then you've had some other successes
that are maybe less known to people because you were more of a behind-the-scenes player. As a producer or as a player musician, maybe not the focal point, maybe not the singer or whatever. I wanted to start off with talking a little bit about one of your first recording efforts when you were in the Marquees. That was on Satellite Records out of Memphis. That was probably one of the first big hit records for Satellite Stax, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was their first million seller, 1961.
Wow. And when you were playing, saxophone on that record, right? Excellent. Who else was in the lineup in the band at that time?
Steve Cropper, Doug Dunn, Wayne Jackson, Terry Johnson, Packy Axton, and somebody else.
There was at what point did Al Jackson come into it? Because did he not play drums, or was he just a studio drummer?
No, he was a studio musician. When we were a high school band at Messick High School in the late 50s, and when Jim Stewart and Estelle Axton, they bought an old movie theater on Macklemore in Memphis, and took the seats out, gutted it, and we used it as a rehearsal hall before they ever put the studio in. And then when they did put the studio in, we played on the first, I don't know, 10 or 15 records they released.
Mm-hmm. Who was the producer on those sessions?
Chips Moman.
Chips.
Jim was a bank teller, and he worked at the bank during the day, and Chips ran it. And Ms. Axton, his sister, had a record shop in what used to be the lobby of the theater. And, she was the main drive for it. She was our mother.
Right. She's kind of mom figure to everybody
in
the band.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a great lady.
Wow. Yeah, I imagine that must have been with something like that, an instrumental record, you know. Like I think I've read in the book, which also I wanted to mention that before the book came out in its form that it's in now, it came out a few years back and had recipes that were from you and your other musician friends and stuff. And I got to say, when I read that, I thought, man, Don is like ahead of the curve here. Like everybody's got these book clubs and stuff now. And a lot of times what people do is say, hey, everybody read the book and then make a dish and bring it to the book club. And man, you're two steps ahead. You got the recipes and the book. So,
when it started, I always wanted to do like a celebrity recipe book.
Right.
So when I would meet people, I would ask for recipes,
mm-hmm.
like from some of the Allman Brothers. And, you know, you run into those people in the South and mm-hmm. you'd get a recipe. And then I got married and I got about 65 recipes. And I counted through them. Then I went and got one of my wife's cookbooks and had like 365. And I thought, well, that ain't going to make it. So I put them in a drawer, kept them. And then when I wrote me memoirs, I thought, well, why waste these recipes? Stick them in the back. And that's how that came to be, which was not a good idea because everybody thought it was a cookbook.
Everybody did think it was a cookbook. Yeah. And actually, when it first got suggested to me as a book that I should pick up, I thought, now, why do I want a recipe book? Why do I want a cookbook?
Exactly. That's what everybody thought, so they didn't buy it. So this thing has no recipes, but it has more text, and it has a lot more photographs, which I'm proud of.
Yeah, I noticed that right away, man. And you are actually the... Now, there's lots of pictures of you in here with other musicians and people that you met along the way, but you took some of these pictures
as
well.
Yeah, I just set the camera up and jump out front.
There's some very cool pictures in here. And some of the best ones are in this one that were not in the last book.
There's many more photographs in this one, which I like. I would like to do a book of photographs. I always carried a camera around. Mm-hmm. Sid Selvidge gave me a camera in 1965. And I carried that camera for years.
Just snapping pictures along the way?
Yeah, you know, I didn't know I was going to do anything with them. I just wanted, you know, for me, for memories.
Speaking of Sid, you produced Sid Selvidge's first album for Enterprise. You were the producer on the album. Were you also kind of the heading up the Enterprise group, the subsidiary for Stax at that point?
No, I never headed up anything.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure. I had read that somewhere, and you get a lot of mixed information.
I did most of their albums because at the time, Enterprise was kind of a pop label for Stax.
Right.
So I did like Moloch and Paris Pilot. There were several pop groups I did for Enterprise, but I was never head up.
Now, for the Sid Salvage album and the Moloch album, those weren't actually cut at Staxa. They were cut at Arden?
Yeah. Arden Studio started, I think, in 63, 64 in John Fry's garage. And I got to hanging out there. And then when he moved to National in Memphis, National Avenue, I went over there and I produced like the first two or three albums at that studio. And then he moved to this studio where we are now.
Yeah.
And continue to work.
Nice. Yeah, those are some classic Memphis records, especially that Sid Salvage album. I remember before we got the tape rolling today, I was asking because I couldn't help myself. I had, you know, being from Memphis myself and having some questions about some of the albums that you produced over the years, because I've listened to them quite a few times and wondered, had questions in my mind about how the records were made.
Did you buy them?
Yeah, I bought them. Yeah. Well, now I got to admit, some of these records were given to me. My dad was a record collector, you know, just in a very casual sense. He was really into music. And so growing up here in Memphis.
So your dad listened to me.
He listened to you. And so that was my
introduction. Now you make me feel old, man. I am old.
You're aging pretty gracefully, I'd have to say.
Well, thank you. I hadn't felt good since 70s, but I think I'm aging all right.
Well, I'm hoping that this book's going to bring you a whole new round of fans. Also, just knowing that the records are still out there and in print, you know. I don't think you have to be of a particular age group to appreciate a really well-made album or a really well-crafted song. And I think some of the songs you've written really prove that. Like Going Down has been covered many, many times.
112.
112 times.
But I didn't write that. I got drunk and made it up in Arden Studios on National.
Is there a difference?
I don't guess it is. But I cut it for the first time on the Moloch album, which was out in 68. Mm-hmm. And then everybody's recorded it.
And you did it with Freddie King for the session for his
right.
album.
Leon Russell and I produced the Freddie King album, Getting Ready.
Mm-hmm. And you had already cut it with Moloch at that point.
Right.
And was it something where you thought, man, it didn't really do anything with Moloch, but if Freddie does it, it'll go somewhere.
I had my first album was out on Shelter, which is Denny Cordell and Leon Russell's label. And then Leon's album came out, and we were on tour promoting both albums. And we were in Denver, and we got a call that they had signed Freddie King. They wanted Leon and me to produce him at Chess Studios in Chicago.
What an opportunity, man.
I thought, my God. So we went up to Chicago, and he had some songs, we had some songs, and I wanted to do Going Down. I could hear it done a different way than Moloch did it, and Leon didn't want to do it. So I, between takes one time, I got Freddie in a corner, and I said, listen to this. Yeah, I like that. So he told Leon, let's cut this song, and we cut it in one take. And just blew everybody away.
Wow.
We needed two songs for the album. And Leon said, let's go out here and write two. So we went out in the studio while everybody else is in the control room to write two songs. But with Leon, that's easy, you know. So we wrote this song called Living on the Highway, I think. and it was about being in different parts of the world. And can't buy a Chitlin pizza for any price I pay. And Leon says, you can't say that. That's racist. And I says, watch this. So I walked in the control room and read the lines to Freddie. He said, oh, yeah. If you listen to the record, that's on there. So we wrote two songs, come back and cut them, and that was it. But Freddie was a very interesting man. He actually worked at Chess as a rhythm guitar player for all those great early records. And he would tell us stories. There was a little canteen there that... And I'm not sure that everybody knows who Freddie King is, but he was the greatest blues man, I think.
One of the greatest. And people, if sometimes people do know him, but only for his guitar work, or know him for his instrumentals. But, man, he could sing.
Hideaway.
Yeah, Hideaway.
And I listened to that on Dewey Phillips when I was in the 12th grade. No, I never made it to the 12th grade. 10th grade.
10th grade.
There's a line in there, and going back to Kosciuszko, Sleep on Sister Irene's Floor. And we made it in one take, but he couldn't think of Kosciuszko. So if you listen to the records, it's Tansanuka, which he made up, which I love.
That's a good word, though.
Yeah, it's great. Freddie King was a joy to work with. He was one of the nicest men I've ever met. And he would tell us stories. We would order out Fat Jack's Chicken in Chicago, had a canteen with a long table. We'd all sit there, and he'd tell us about playing different sessions with Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and people like that. It was
what an experience.
Oh, man. I couldn't sleep for a month after getting home.
And you mentioned first hearing Freddie King's Hideaway on Dewey Phillips' Red Hot and Blue show. And I know from reading your book that you also got to know Dewey pretty well.
I did.
Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, I guess from the time I was in the ninth grade, Red Hot and Blue was the biggest, you know, show at night.
Oh, yes, sir. That's Octopus. Opus number one right there. The late, great Tommy Dorsey. Yes, sir. Good people. It's old Pop Chop. Don't forget, buddy. Yes, sir. We got one of the hottest cotton picking shows in the country. It's called Pop Chop. Yes, sir. We own television and radio at the same time from 3:30 to 4:30 every afternoon. Yes, sir. And we average about 88 telegrams a day. That's getting the main ideas. Whoop, you're messing up, partner. That's right. Is that right, dears? That's right, partner. You call Sam? No, I gotta call Sam in a minute, dear. Oh, hanging long hair.
I'm all right. I'm all right.
That'll be everybody's all right. Well, I have a big
He played what was in Race Records. And no other station in Memphis were playing the music he was playing, so everybody it was better than watching TV. I mean, Dewey Phillips was the most amazing disc jockey I've ever heard in my life. And he would play all these records. So later on, I guess I was about 18 or so, he was at the Chiska Hotel on a magazine floor. And I went down there one night, and I just walked up, and there's a glass. He's in the booth, and I'm watching him. He says, come on in. I went and sat in the floor while he was, I mean, what a great
Well, that's like sitting at the foot of the master.
It was. I'm sitting here with Dewey Phillips.
Amazing. And a lot of people that know a little bit about music history will know about Dewey's connection with Elvis Presley. He was one of the first people to spin Elvis's son's sides, and also became just a benefactor to Elvis as far as like making sure that people heard his records. And
yeah, but Elvis disowned him because he was
a little too country, I guess, in the
no,
end.
No, he was a little too high. I remember one time I was at Sun Records, and Knox Phillips and everybody, we were all around the front desk. And a guy came in, and they were looking for somebody, a musician that had taken a car across state lines, FBI agent.
Whoa.
And me and Dewey and Knox and all of us, Stan Kessler, and this guy flipped out the FBI ID. And I heard these feet going, and Dewey was scooting backwards trying to get out of there. He thought they were after him.
Lordy, Lord, I'll tell you right now, friends, I'm as nervous as a cotton-picking frog on a freeway with his hopper busted. I'm in bad shape. Telling you, I got a new song we're going to play here. They're going to cut loose this new song I wrote here today called Get Off the Turntables, Mabel. You're too old to be going around with musicians. That ought to get it. All you guys up there ought to put me on network. That ought to flat get it. We've been on Red Hot and Blue here for 8 pea-picking years and Pop Chop for about 3. Say, can't you see Mr. Neal up there and get me a raise, will you?
Hey, we had mentioned a little bit earlier about Chip Smoman, who produced and engineered that first Marquise record. And then you had also, I had asked a little bit about the first 45 that you'd done under your own name, Donnie Nix, Ain't About to Go Home. And you were saying that Chips had also produced that record and that that was done over at his American studios. Now, that record, I found that record at a thrift store here when I was a teenager, and I always loved it. And I saw that it had a Memphis address on the label, and I thought, man, this record is from Memphis, and I love it. It's such a great rock and roll song with a kind of chug and Chuck Berry type riff and everything. Two guitar leads. I mean, at that time when I found that record, that was exactly the kind of record I loved. And just the whole the lyric about being a soda jerk at Walgreens, like, I mean, it had everything that a teenage kid could want in a song.
I wish everybody liked it.
Well, actually, it's a pretty legendary record, and the station where this interview is going to air, people are familiar with that record.
Yeah. Bless your heart. Well, that wasn't even the A side. I don't even know what was on the other side, but we cut it, and then Chip said, well, you need a B side. So Terry Johnson, who was the Marquis drummer,
mm-hmm.
and this was on Thomas Street, which is a busy street in Memphis, and I said, well, let's go out here and write something. Now, Terry had never written a song. I hadn't written many songs, so we went outside. And we did I Ain't About to Go Home. We wrote that in about 5 minutes, standing on the street. It's Thomas and Chelsea. Come back in. Here it is. That's Charlie Freeman on guitar.
Is it just one? Is he doing both leads?
Yeah. We overdubbed and sped the guitar up on the second one. That's why it sounds kind of weird.
Nice. Well, it sounds great, man. And then I think I cannot remember the flip side right now. It has escaped. The title of the other side is escaping me. But I noticed that also it had a Laddie Hutchison songwriting credit. Laddie, who was also in the Guillotines.
Yeah, that was the ace. God, I wish I could think
it's
of it.
It's Something
that.
Got a Girl or...
I don't know.
Something with Girl in the title, which it's a good pop song, but really... Ain't About to Go Home is the rocker.
I saw her yesterday. Here's what she had to say. I'm sorry for the things I've done. She said she didn't know that
what's weird about that is I went on YouTube. Somebody said go on YouTube and look it up. And there's a couple of Mexican bands
that cover it.
That covered it, doing it in Spanish.
How wild is that? And that tells you right there that that song has traveled further than you thought it would.
Traveled? I didn't think it'd get to the street.
Because that, like I say, that is that's a record with a Belvedere address. Were you living on Belvedere at that time?
No, that was a guy named Jerry Williams who paid for the record.
Oh, that's a Jerry Williams thing.
He had the guillotines, and, and we're going way back. You have to be pretty old to remember all these people.
Well, that's definitely my favorite. You know, 60 to 67 or so is some of my most favorite Memphis music came out around that time. So speaking of that whole time frame, and then after the Donnie Nix record, you also released a 45 on XL. And that label was that label out of Binghamton or?
No, that was out of Sun. That was Stan Kessler.
That was Stan Kessler.
He was an engineer at Sun, and okay. He cut that. God, I don't know what year that was, maybe 66 or something. He was Sam the Sham's producer. He had just cut Woolly Bully on Sam the Sham.
And that came out on XL as well,
yeah.
Before it got licensed.
MGM picked that up. And I was living with Sam the Sham then, down here on Poplar and Cooper.
Oh, no way. So you guys were roommates.
Yeah. And then when the record hit, he had a 55 Pontiac, green and white, and... he couldn't pay his rent, so he gave me the Pontiac.
He had many more Pontiacs coming in his future. Now he had a deal with MGM.
He's still a good friend. He's still here in Memphis.
Is he still living in Memphis?
Oh, yeah. You know this is an interview for people 50 and over.
That's quite all right. I think you've just had a fascinating career, and I'm just trying to touch on some points that, you know, people may not get this information elsewhere, or other people might not ask you these questions.
You can ask me anything.
Well, one thing that really moved me in the book, man, really touched me, is your stories about you hanging out with Furry Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us how you first came to know Furry?
I don't know the first time I ever met Furry. But if I start telling Furry Lewis stories, we'd be here all day and all night.
Well, give me the best one you got then.
One of the greatest things in my life, I did an album with Elektra Records called Living by the Days, and then we did a tour, the Alabama State Troopers. And it was supposed to be myself, Junie Green, and Lonnie Mack. We were all Elektra artists at that time.
The super group.
And then we went down to Muscle Shoals to rehearse for the tour, and Lonnie quit. He was staying in the room next to me, and he woke me up at 4 in the morning and says, I'm going home.
And it was this, I think I read in the book, that it was some kind of religious revelation he had.
We named the background choir the Mount Zion Singers because it was the Mount Zion, it was a black church.
Mm-hmm.
But he read his Bible, and he read the one night, "Get thee out of Zion." And so he thought that meant him, so he left. I thought, well, great, we'll get Furry Lewis. So we got Furry for the tour, and it was a great honor, man, to tour with that man. He was 87 or something. I don't
know.
Wow. But he was one of the original Delta Blues players.
Yeah.
He wrote John Henry. He invented the slide guitar, the bottleneck guitar.
That's you guys really had the secret weapon then. I mean, you had something that other groups traveling around did not have. You know, a lot of it's one thing to go out and see a bunch of young white people who really admire and try to replicate the blues so that people can know what it's all about. But man, you guys had Furry Lewis with you, you know, like,
you know, but at the time it was just I love Furry and I did, you know, I just wanted him with me.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was going to turn out to be like it was because he came on first and did 30 minutes. And after that, I mean, they bought anything we had because they had never seen anything like that. Yeah.
John Henry hammering the mountain. Tell the head of his hammer caught a fire. Try pick him up, or then let him down again. One cool drink of water before I die, die. One cool drink of water before I die, die. John Henry had a little woman. And the dress she wore was blue. Down the railroad track, heard her voice hind a sand. John Henry sure been true to you. Good John Henry sure been true to you. John Henry sure been true to you.
Fantastic. What so with Leon Russell, you did your first solo album with his Shelter Records.
I recorded it in Muscle Shoals, though.
And you had David Hood and a lot of those guys.
Roger Hawkins, Barry Beckett, Jimmy Johnson, Wayne Perkins.
Yep.
Eddie Hinton.
It's a fantastic record, man. It's one of my one of my favorites of all your albums.
Well, thank you.
So many great songs on there. And I think also it's... You're a humble guy when it comes to your vocal abilities.
I have no vocal abilities.
There you go. There's your humbleness coming through right there. But it's kind of amazing to me because it really some of my most favorite singers that I've ever heard are people that don't have or maybe not the most gifted people vocally. Maybe they weren't born with a lot of talent for having, you know, performing like vocal feats or anything. But that means that they got to put more into it with the feeling of the song, and they got to have they got to be wittier. They got to be, you know, they got to have something that the person who has that natural ability doesn't have to put to win them over, you know. And you got that, so.
I didn't know I had that.
Yeah,
because I was always told you can't sing. This is that first record ain't about to go home. Chip's telling me, well, you can't sing. So I said, I don't care. I like it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got to where I just hated going out on the road. It just motels and
yeah,
it just got it got unbearable almost. And I'd always wanted to write and produce. And so I stopped in touring and I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I couldn't find anybody who wanted to cut my songs. So I did them myself. I went down to Muscle Shoals that first album. I paid for those sessions. And then I went out and played them for Leon and Denny. And they put them out on Shelter. And that kind of started. That started me.
Mm-hmm. And then after your contract with Shelter ended, that's when you signed with Elektra?
Right. Jack Holzman signed me. They gave me $35,000 for my album that cost me $1,100.
That's how you went. You came out on top.
That was in 72. I mean, $35,000 in 1972 was a lot of, it still is a lot of money, but yeah. Back then, and I came home, I bought my parents a new house with it. And that was that's what I'm most thankful for, is getting my parents a home.
Yep.
I did a tour of Japan year before last, and that was kind of my farewell to the music business.
Yeah. Who did, when you went out, did you go out with a full band?
Yeah, or? We used a couple of Japanese musicians, too, that were really good. It was a good tour.
So you used some people from Japan for the touring act for your kind of farewell tour?
Right.
And was it just Japan, or did you guys go anywhere else?
No.
Just Japan.
Yeah. I'd never been to Japan as a headliner. Mm-hmm. I think I went over there with John Mayall once, but my records always did better in Japan than anywhere in the world. And it was an eye-opener for me. It was, you know, we had crowds every night. It was, I really enjoyed being in Japan. If I could get back over there, if it wasn't for the 15-hour plane flight, I would go back, but it's just too much on old dad.
That's a lot of travel. There's, I noticed, actually when I first started doing a little bit of research about you and about the book and about how to, you know, if at some point I could plug your albums and tell people where they could order them and stuff, I noticed that a lot of your back catalog is mainly available through Japanese imprints.
Yeah.
And so I thought, man, he must have a big following there. And
it was amazing to me. It surprised me. You know, I thought, well, ain't nobody going to show up for this. And it was packed every night.
Fantastic, man.
And they were $90 a ticket.
You're kidding me.
Tokyo's like the most expensive city I hear.
Yeah. And there was, what size houses were you playing?
Well, I couldn't see them really. So
it's dark.
they were music halls.
Okay.
They have great music halls there.
Yep.
We played in three nights in Tokyo and Kyoto, Osaka, and in Kobe.
Nice. I bet you guys had a great time.
Oh, yeah.
That's the way to do it. I also read in your book, I loved your stories about hanging out with Larry Raspberry and the High Steppers. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Larry?
I think I met Larry when he was 15. And he started a band called the Gentries,
mm-hmm.
and they were on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour. And I remember I was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, the last night they played, and they won a recording contract or something for that deal, and they put out Keep On Dancing. And then Larry went on, had a great career, still has. He still plays all around, and I still see him. He lives in California, but he comes back and we hang out, him and Carol, his wife.
And
I produced a couple of albums on him.
Did you produce some of the High Steppers albums?
Yeah, I did In the Pink, I think.
That's a great one.
Yeah. I did that here, right in this studio.
There was also one of the highlights of your book is you talking about helping put the Bangladesh concert together with George Harrison.
I didn't.
Or the choir, I should
say. Yeah, he asked me, he was living in California, and I went and stayed with him there, him and Klaus Voormann, mm-hmm. his wife and his dad. And he was putting this all together. And He asked me if I knew a Southern soul choir I could put together, and I said, sure. And so I got all the people that were there together, and he said, well, you come up and sing too. And I thought, well, I don't know. And, but I did, and made the movie.
Fantastic.
You can't really see me that much, but I was in there. That was a great day. Yeah, I had my hat on.
You had a very, you had a signature trademark hat going there at that time, didn't you?
Yeah.
There was
it's in the Stax Museum.
Is it in the Stax Museum?
Yeah, my clothes are in a museum. That's how old I am.
There was every time I look in the book, like there's lots of pictures of you wearing that hat, and I actually, the thought did cross my mind, I wonder where that hat is. Now I know. We can all visit it at the Stax Museum.
Yeah.
You know, other than going down, you got a pretty big body of work as far as published material. That, with the fact that some of these records are still in print and have been reissued, do you still see in a good bit of publishing money from some of those songs?
Yeah, that's what I raised my family on, and that's what I live on. I've been fortunate enough to have some songs in movies lately, and I had a theme song for a TV series called Eastbound and Down on HBO.
Nice.
Had a song in the movie Flight, Denzel Washington. Then I had a song in the last Star Trek movie.
Man, sync licenses can really save a writing musician.
They've been good to Don.
Yep. That really can make all of the difference in the world, because a lot of people that aren't musicians out there don't know. They think that selling records is what it's all about.
I've also got the new, what is that place you worked? Guitar Center Christmas commercials for Going Down.
Oh, nice.
But I still work, still try to produce, not much now, but last year I did an album on my friend Danny Green, which I'm very proud of.
Where did you guys do that record at?
Here.
Right here in Arden. Fantastic.
Who brought you a copy? That guy. Adam Hill.
If I didn't mention it already, we're actually doing this interview today from Ardent Studios and Studio
courtesy
A.
Courtesy of Adam Hill.
Courtesy of Adam Hill, who's a fantastic engineer. And Danny Green, who did all the driving today. Well, man, thank you so much, Don, for making time for this interview today and talking to us and telling us some stories. And we really appreciate it. And we hope that people will definitely go out and buy Memphis Man, Living High, Laying Low. It is a fantastic read. Lots of good stories and reminiscences about the rock and roll industry and being on the road and all the luminaries that you met along the way. Thank you so much, Don.
Thank you, Greg. I enjoyed it. My trouble.
that you're looking for. And you know things in my past. I know the things that you've let slip away. 'Cause you didn't think they would last. I've seen you laugh, but you hold back the tears. That you see, you're amazed, and you're hoping to be living for hundreds of years. Well, I'm only living by the day. I'm only living by. We'll be right back.
Well, alrighty, just about to get out of here. You tune into WYXR 91.7 right here in Memphis, Tennessee. This is the Big G here with Strange Mysterious Sounds. Every Wednesday, 4 until 5 p.m. Today we aired an interview with Don Nix. Just lost him just a little over a week ago. Producer, singer, songwriter, such a talented Memphis musician. He will be missed. Keep tuned right here for more music. Max Man is coming up next.